The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
Well, we finally made it to Asia. 52 patriarchs. And I don't remember when we started, but...
We started January 16th, 2016.
Really?
Uh-huh.
How about that? Well, it's been a good 2 years.
Well, it's certainly been 2 years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Want to read the case, Julia?
Sure. Ajo studied with Zen Master Dogen. One day in the course of inquiries, he heard the saying, "One hair goes through myriad holes," and all of a sudden realized enlightenment. That evening, he went to Dogen and said, "I do not ask about the one hair. What about the myriad holes?" Dogen smiled and said, "Gone through." Ajo bowed. Shall I go on?
I want to say something about this phrase, "a single hair pierces many holes." Anybody want to say anything about what that suggests? Mm-hmm. Why hearing that might bring a person to awakening? What it has to do with anything? What's the issue?
What's the image? Is it like threading a needle, or is it?
Yeah, I think something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting using the image of the hair as opposed to a thread, which is like, I think, more commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
So say you can't ever miss threading the needle?
Well,
It evokes the non-duality. I can't figure out whether it evokes duality or non-duality, but the image of the
It's a good bet it's one or the other,
and
right?
Yes.
Well, it could be both.
Yes, and the... you know, the thread, you know, and creating holes, and yet you have the whole fabric and the whole, there's separation.
Yeah, I think something like that. I think one thing that's a little confusing is the image of a hair is often used someplace in other contexts when they talk about a hair's breadth.
Mm-hmm.
That is a symbol of separation, just one hair's breadth between one thing and another, and you're lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this has, this I think is right, is more like the image of the thread going through every hole. And the and so you've got something set up between the one and the many. Right? And so there's a way in which there's a kind of single truth that goes through every circumstance,
mm-hmm.
right? That does that penetrates every situation, right? And so when he's says, irrespective of the single hair, what are the many holes? One way of thinking about that is that I'm not asking about, expressing or attaining the single thing, but what is our relation to the many,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And completely pierced means that you could sort of say You know, if it's a thread, all tied together, right? All, you know, completely incorporated, you know, into the net of Indra, the seamless net. Right?
Yours says pierced?
Yeah. Ours says gone through.
Gone through.
Yes, it says pierced as in, I guess, goes through. It's again, whether you have the image of a needle, you know, piercing things or going through the hole, right?
What does yours say? Pierced through?
Just pierced.
Pierced.
Oh, just
pierced.
Pierced.
But you say that, the image of the holes could be taken as sort of like insufficiency or lacking, and saying like, I'm not asking you about the hair, which is like this inexhaustible thing, but where was there anything lacking?
You could say that the relative is the realm of lack, and that itself is being seen as the pierced by the absolute, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of Dogen Soto style, you could see the many holes as all the particulars of everyday life, of monastic ritual. And there's going to be in here in the circumstances, sort of a discussion of the absolute nature of all the monastic rules. Right? So that the rules and the rituals of daily life, the way Dogen says practice and enlightenment are identical, right? It's as if the principle of enlightenment permeates or goes through the every detail of everyday life, right? And so none of them are considered relative, trivial, replaceable, or anything else, right?
Gone through reminds me of the gateless gate business, where he's almost like he's saying, you know, like, I'm not asking about the key, I'm asking about the many locks. And he's like, all unlocked.
All unlocked, right? Or or everything's a gate. Right?
Enter anywhere.
Yeah, enter anywhere. Right?
It's funny, when I originally read this, I didn't think of this, but after you gave this talk this morning, I kept thinking that you could even see this as a metaphor for that, like these myriad holes in a way. Is our body, which we experience as myriad things, and there's that, is there this one thing we're thinking of, I, that always seems to be there in this body?
All of it, huh?
Yeah, I guess you could say that something about the porosity that the term of the holes implies, and how like there's this isn't like the solid body, there's like flow and like exchange.
It's constantly permeable, right? It's constantly changing, right?
And the hair is not, is that the
The idea of the hair in a certain sense is in this unchanging, unifying side of things, dimension, and he's going to...
And yet isn't it like a tiny little thing almost that's...
Yes.
What is his little hair?
Yeah, he's going to play with that at the very end of this Tesha, where basically he says, utterly empty, it is marvelously bright by nature. It is pure and naked, empty and spotless, obvious, bright and shining. And there's not a hair of doubt or a whisper of false thought. You see, that's the turning that metaphor back on itself. It's brighter than a billion suns and moons. Right? You cannot say it's white, you cannot say it's red. So it was a It has neither inside nor outside, therefore do not say a single hip pierces many holes. So what through piercing can it be? So the single hair is also that kind of boundless, undefinable thusness.
That's a thing in Buddhism, right? Like when they make something like really small, it's to say like it excludes nothing, or like something subtle or unsurpassable includes everything.
Yeah. Let's read a little of his story. Let me see. It starts with him being once again a very special child, still being a monk at training at Mount Hiei, where Dogen first started, and then it sort of picks up. With his meeting Dogen, and sort of.
So he had a Pure Land background too, though.
Yes, he had the same background as Dogen did. And
what is
and it, well, so it says, you know, he felt like he had already. Had an enlightenment experience of some sort. But then when Dogen came back from China, he said, what could Dogen have brought from China? He visited Dogen to find out. During the several days they first talked, they thought they saw things the same way. And discussed the inconceivable knowledge of seeing essential nature. The master was overjoyed, thinking his understanding was the same as Dogen's and genuine, and he praised Dogen all the more. Yeah, he thinks just like I do. Right? However, after several days passed, Priest Dogen revealed an extremely different understanding. And at that time, the master was surprised and about to raise an argument, but realized that there was something beyond his own truth and quite different.
That's so funny. It's just, that's such a thing when like two people from different types of Buddhism kind of hang out for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this first perceived overlap.
Uh-huh.
And then
you start trying to figure out which differences make a difference, right? And
even within Zen, you know, two people from different Zendos talking.
Yes, it's not clear exactly where Dogen was and how this was doing. This has Dogen saying, he built a hermitage outside the monastery and 2 years passed without a single person visiting. And then Dogen, Ijo returns after this time to study with him and then has this encounter. And then once he has this, he becomes Dogen's disciple, and he was like a shadow following him form for 20 years.
So strange.
Right, so having completely realized that he becomes completely identified with Dogen and then follows him into the establishment of Heiji, and Dogen then, you know, makes him the practice leader there. Then we get this. Very unfortunate story about the rules of the monastery. It's Says it was written on the bulletin board regarding the time period allowed for being absent from the monastery. Twice a month, 3 days each time. And even when Ajo's mother was terminally ill and he visited her, he did not violate the time limit. Her request to see him for the last time because she was seriously ill had occurred frequently, so the whole community urged him to go regardless of the time limit. Although the master had thought deeply about the matter, he wanted to know what the community thought. He got them all together and announced, "I would like to see my mother for the last time, and I wonder if I should violate the rule and go." Every one of more than 50 monks agreed that even though the time limit was the rule, he should, and he would not be able to see his mother again, so he should go. The whole community was united in this suggestion. The discussion was heard by Dogen, who said to himself, "Ajo's made up his mind. He will not leave. He does not agree with the group." Sure enough, after the community made its deliberations, the master told the community, "The rules of the Buddha patriarch are more important than the opinions of the community. The rule is without question a rule of conduct fixed by former enlightened people. If I were to comply with human feelings towards my mother, and transgress the regulations of former enlightened people, how could I avoid extremely unfilial wrongs toward her? What I mean is that by transgressing regulations now, I would cause even greater wrong to my mother after she dies." This must be a footnote that says the height of sophistry. A person who makes his home departure should make his parents enter the way. By following human feelings just once, will he cause his parents to receive eternal ruination? So saying, he did not follow the community's suggestion. The community was surprised, but they did not disagree. They all praised him as truly a person with determination that is difficult to come by.
But that whole story is not,
that's
in,
not in here.
It's not in our book at all.
Not at all.
Not a mention of it.
Well, they've whitewashed me.
Oh, yeah, Kazan is whitewashed.
They didn't like that story.
Somebody whitewashed.
It's interesting that that's
it's not there
not
at
yeah.
all.
Not
a word.
But we have read, I have read that story somewhere else.
Well, we've heard some version of that in another teacher.
The sixth patriarch, what we name. His mother, like he abandoned his
well,
mother.
Well, he left his mother, who had no other
poor.
Means of support, and went to the monastery. And then there's another one who
was she outside
the
monastery?
His mother came outside the monastery and wanted to see him one last time, and he wouldn't let her in.
Yeah.
Die outside the gates, right? As an expression of compassion, right? So there's
Weka had better luck. It's weird.
Huh?
Weka had better luck with
yeah.
that.
Yes, right. There are a lot of ways to think about that. One is how there is a simultaneously this intense filial and ancestral devotion, but one that is transferred or displaced onto the teacher and the Dharma, right? So that what you're demonstrating is a kind of absolutism for the Dharma that ordinary people would express towards their parents, right? It's not entirely clear that this is anything we want to emulate, but it's a model of the absolutism of home, the idea of home leaving. It's also a little peculiar for Kazan in that he's extremely devoted to his mother. And the women in the picture of women is Avalokiteshvara. So but the other thing I would say about it has to do with in terms of the attitude towards rules and rituals, where rules are not things set up by consensus in the community. The rules are presented as having been created by enlightened masters and handed down generation after generation, and they're not ours to modify or regulate according to circumstances. Right? There's something ahistorical about them, and there's something that's not just a matter of functionality, but of really that the rule themselves embodies the Dharma, right? It's as if every aspect of the schedule is treated like the sacrament of the Mass, right? You know, and that this is my body. You know, this is my body. This is my blood. This is where God is making himself manifest in the world in this moment through this ritual enactment, right? So it's as if not just this one symbolic moment, but everything we do morning till night has that kind of absolute sacramentalized significance, right? And that's a way of thinking one hair you know, pierces every hole, right? Everything is absolutely sacramentalized, right? And so, you know, you don't, in that kind of model, you know, it's not like the group can just get together and say, you know, I think we ought to start doing it this way instead, right? Let's have a show of hands, right? There's no way in which democracy would be a virtue in this model, right?
So I've been, whenever I think about this stuff, I've been trying to ground the particular teaching in the context of the teacher. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, this is what he's there to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, like if he doesn't go along with the schedule business, you know, if his teacher were a psychoanalyst, you know, it would be the error not to go see the mother, but that's what he would have been here to learn. So this is very particular to a teacher. Like, I think that business about being his shadow is a methodology.
Well, I think it's I think it's trying to reflect what is Dogen's particular unique
realization.
Insight or realization. Yeah. And what's the particular expression of that? And that is this identity of practice and realization taken all the way. Right? It's not just sitting that is the identity of practice and realization. It's you can leave the monastery twice a month for 3 days is the identity of practice and realization, right?
I guess it's meant to be shocking, the inviolability of the routine, the rules.
Yes, I mean, it's there's a way in which the absolutism is meant to be shocking but exemplary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of, this is a the mark of a saint, someone who puts aside human feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It would be a very different story if all the members of the Sangha got together and decided that it was okay to make an exception, and the moral of the story was that, you know, the rules apply except when your mother is
Well, you could imagine a story that, you know, where a person says, you know, this practice exists so that we can cultivate compassion. There's no point in talking about that all day and then being cruel to your mother, right? I mean, it might be nice if somebody drew that kind of lesson for a change, right?
Yeah.
But there is a particularity to their different insights.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm not trying to learn Dogen's insights by being here.
Right. I think that's right. From my perspective, it is a particular and one-sided kind of insight. But that's my perspective, is that insight can have many facets like that. And I think that we would not want to run a community like that, or we would not want to think about the rules that way. But there's something about training in that where there's a kind of total surrender to the form that can be deeply transformative to people. It could also be deeply traumatizing and rigid, but if it's genuine surrender, if it's really a kind of, I simply will be in a mode of thy will be done as a way to be get out of my own personal preoccupations, then it can be genuinely liberating. But it's a powerful medicine with powerful side effects for other people.
I don't understand how that can work. I don't understand how somebody could give themselves over to an authoritarian
Well, it's the difference between submission and surrender, which I tried to write about. Nothing is hidden, and I had a long thing in there quoting Manny Gent, who wrote about that from a psychoanalytic perspective. And what we usually encounter is submission, the substitution of another person's will for your will. But surrender is something else, where you're not surrendering to a person, but you're simply letting go in the presence of someone else or through the facilitation of a person or a form. The way I usually talk about it at Sesshin is that the first day of Sesshin is like stepping on an escalator. You just take that first step and it carries you along for the rest of the Sesshin, right? You give yourself over to something. And once you've stepped on the escalator, all you want to do is allow yourself to say yes to the next thing, right? You don't try to say, I don't think I'm going to get up as early as everybody else. And I think I need a few more snacks than they give us at the meals. And I have reading and writing I want to do at night, right? You don't pick and choose and try to control it in any way. You just say, I'm just going to let myself have this pre-designed experience, regardless of whether it's the way I would want it or the way I design it. I'm just going to give myself over to that, right?
And that would require a considerable trust that this escalator is going where
it's going to take you.
Yeah. It's considerable trust. It's surrender is an act of complete trust.
Okay? And also in the course of the Sesshin, where it makes you, it bumps you up constantly or frequently against what you don't want.
What you don't want.
Because you're following something.
Yes,
that
and then
isn't
every
geared
moment,
to what you want.
In every moment, it's a question of what's supposed to give. You know, my likes or dislikes or the schedule. And can you trust the schedule? Can you trust that there's a point to not having it your way, right? Most people have a hard time really believing that or trusting it that totally. Mm-hmm. But a sesshin is an exercise in trust. Even a trust that even though I may be physically in pain, I trust that there's something valuable in just letting this happen. That's what surrender means. It is a word of trust. Here you've got a sense in Dogen of a kind of trust and absolute sacramentalization of every aspect of the monastic ritual.
This might be like outside of our scope, but I have a hard time imagining how that was medicine for their particular situation. Like, I understand how, like, in our culture, where, like, we can make decisions about everything we want, why that would be, like, powerful. But in medieval Japan, I feel like I'm missing something.
Well, yeah, you figure medieval Japan people are not under-regulated.
Right.
Right.
You farm now, yeah.
I guess the point is that it is a culture, though very devoted to family and family ties.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Right? So that this is an example of what does it mean to genuinely home leave and break the ordinary sense of family responsibility, right? Maybe that's the sense of it.
I think it's interesting that they left the entire story out
yeah.
of this version. I mean, and there's got to be something to that. That's not, that was intentional, of course. And
it's Thomas Cleary, too. It's not
right,
like
so,
he's...
Right.
So either he was so offended by it and decided it didn't work, or he felt that it was a misinterpretation of something, perhaps. I don't know.
Or that it was...
It seems odd that it would just be
there's
gone.
There's no editorial note.
No.
Oh,
no,
thing.
He's
maybe,
not that, no.
Maybe he decided that it was... Not
spurious.
Yeah. Right, spurious, right. Not actually.
You don't agree with it, you decide to
throw
it
out. Right, exactly. But there's plenty of other stuff I'm sure he didn't agree with in this book that he didn't take out.
Mm-hmm. See if there's any else.
This might be a little off the point, but there is a story. Dogen tells a story elsewhere about some starving guy, peasant comes to the abbot of a monastery and says, "Can you help us? You know, we have no food." And the abbot takes the copper halo off a saint relic, and he molds it into a ball and gives it to the starving guy to feed his family. And one of the monks says, "You've taken the holy property of the monastery. You're going to fall into hell for this." And he says, "That's all right, as long as I've helped the starving people."
That's good. That's good.
So
occasionally you get these kinds of stories of that are in a way meant, I think, to go against the grain of fetishizing, ritual objects, right? There's one other good paragraph here I wanted to get to. It says, "Even if you're conversant with the 12-part canon of the three vehicles and expound its many doctrines, ultimately you are like a cat watching for a rat. Outwardly you appear still, but inside your mind continues to seek. Even if your practice is meticulous, the realm of mind is never calm day or night. The result is that your doubt is not cleared up. You are like a fox who runs off quickly but doesn't get far because he keeps looking back over his shoulder. This is the life of a fox apparition that has not stopped toying with his spirit."
This is like a fox that runs fast yet makes slow progress because it keeps looking back. This is a life of playing with the spirit. Mm-hmm. The life of a foxy devil whose changing apparition has not ceased.
Foxy devil.
So, yes. Foxy devil.
So the fox and the cat here are both images of
fox and rat. Okay.
Of attachment, of gaining ideas, right? And so he says, even if you appear to sit very still and are very focused, if you've got a gaining idea, if you're doing this in order to attain something, you're like a cat looking at the mouse hole, you know, waiting all the time for the mouse to appear. You want something that you haven't got, mm-hmm. right? And that, I think, is the the attitude that Dogen in particular is trying to create an alternative to, where the sitting is complete fulfillment in itself, right? That you don't have to catch anything, right? You're not trying to get anything. And you're not constantly looking over your own shoulder. You're not seeing how far have I come, how am I doing, you know, or is anybody checking up on me, right? Mm-hmm. It's this kind of sitting as completeness, not sitting as a place to get somewhere, right?
Well, this is a very clear marker of, like, you know, are you waiting for something?
Yeah, are you waiting for something to happen, right?
Mm-hmm. But can't you just as easily get caught up in, boy, look how well I'm sitting. Boy, I'm the best sitter that ever came down the pipe.
Yes, I think that there's certainly a kind of ditch on the other side of the road of total complacency and self-congratulation, right?
That's why I love this term, the foxy devil. I think that's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, and also if you're, this may be too simplified, but if you're constantly looking back or waiting, you're never in the moment. I mean, I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I think that's right. You're not in the moment.
You're not present.
You're on the run, and you're always looking past or forward, back or forward. Right. His alternative to this is, it is simply vivid alertness within yourself.
Yes.
So we call it vivid alertness. That's good. Calling it alertness means that you are very awake. Calling it bright just means it's very bright. You don't have to say it as either inside or outside, or extends into the past or the present. To me, this kind of vivid alertness is just meant to mean a sense of sitting with a sense of completeness, right? That really, that this is it, this vivid awareness of the present moment and the ritualization through sitting as a way of framing the moment. It is the whole enchilada.
It also reminds me of some of the technical definitions of Shikantaza of, like, objectless meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the cat without the mouse hole. Like, there's just...
Yeah, it's... It's the cat having swallowed the mouse.
Oh. In this last page, he seems to summarize. Says all you should not be fond of academic learning.
Mm-hmm.
All you should do is arouse your will for the moment, even for an instant. And then a little later, he says, if you have such true determination, once this will is solidified, you will penetrate through to realization. So it sounds like determination is the key. He goes on for a couple of paragraphs about determination.
Uh-huh. It's... in a way, it's hard to know what it means exactly, because you're trying to say it's not conceptual learning. You're not doing academic study where you're trying to acquire knowledge. But at the same time, you don't want to be like the cat trying to catch a rat, right? You're not, it's not determination to get something, but it's a determination to be present in some ways. It's a determination to be as completely present as you can, with a sense that everything you need to find, you're going to find right here, right? And that's an interesting kind of way to approach practice, you know, with the sense that whatever I need, I'm going to find it in this moment, as this moment is, not I'm going to transform this moment into one of those really good special moments, but I'm going to find it in the midst of my wandering mind or my doubt or my pain, that those are all holes that are pierced by the one thread, right?
Does yours have the poem at the end with it?
How is it?
Space has never admitted even a needle.
Good. Say it, read it.
The poem is, space has never admitted even a needle. In the vastness, there is nothing to rely on. So who is there to discuss it? Do not say one hair goes through myriad holes. The bare, clean ground hasn't a trace.
Say the last
one. The bare,
one.
Clean ground hasn't
the bare,
a trace.
Clean, the,
the bare, clean ground hasn't a trace. After we began the chapter with the positive statement about a hair going through myriad holes, and
now he's sort
already
of,
gone through.
And yes, gone through. Now it's sort of there's the emptiness of the needle, the emptiness of the holes. There's nothing but this clear ground of the moment, you could say, that there's nothing lacking, nothing to gain, and there, in a sense, and then it's featureless, right? It's completely clear, it's just this.
If you do not see the way, you don't see it even as you walk on it, right?
Yeah.
So
I think that's the basic Soto lesson, you know. It's you're already walking on it in the midst of, even in the midst of your delusion and doubt, right? Those things themselves are dharmic phenomena, you know. They're just, that is how the absolute is unfolding moment after moment in your delusion, right?
You're already walking on it. What was
yeah.
it? What is it?
You know, the way.
The way.
The great.
Your life.
It's the Dharma gate is open and the great way lies beneath your feet, extending freely in every direction. Yeah.
Mm.
You can't miss.
Boy, is that hard to wrap your mind around.
That's hard to believe. I have that sense of this life with old age, sickness, death, loneliness, all that good stuff, that's the great way. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are all the many holes pierced by one thread. You know, in a sense, Dogen is saying that as long as you run around in the midst of your lay life, you won't realize those things are the way. But if you create this sacramentalized container within that, old age, sickness, and death will then appear as part of the way.
Because that way or that container are all porous, changing, all the impermanent, you know, all the time, it's everything is shifting.
Well, yeah.
No, the ground is porous, like the body is porous.
Mm. Myriad holes.
Yes.
Yes, well, life has all, as it is, has all those qualities, so you don't get a life that's more porous in a monastery than your life outside the monastery, right? Mm-hmm. Things are just as empty out here as in there, right? Mm-hmm. It's as if the ritualized container allows you to experience it differently or tolerate it differently or recognize it.
Well, it's harder out here, I think.
Well, for some people it's harder here, for some people it's harder there. I mean, I don't know.
But back to one of the points we were talking about earlier, it seems like in that context the container of the monastic life is rules, and that's why the rules are made to be so stringent.
Yeah, it's hard. It's to call it a container in Dogen's terms is to make it a little too functional.
Mm-hmm.
We would think of it as a container, as a way to allow yourself to experience both the sacrament and the impermanence, right? He would just say it is. The rules are the expression of the realization. The rules are what enlightened people have laid down as a way to live an enlightened life, right? The way the Vinaya was originally conceived, which was with all these rules, you create a form of life that itself manifests dependence and impermanence, right? You have no fixed abode, you rely on alms, mm-hmm. right? So that the life, the prescribed life, is one that manifests the teaching,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's what's tricky about the lay life, is that, like, the life that manifests the teaching and the life that manifests your desires are, like, you know, hair's breadth apart sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but your desires manifest the teaching as much as anything else, because your desires are a constant demonstration of, you know, of ungraspability, right? Everything will elude control and permanence. So it is. You know, in that sense,
it's
daily life is a perfectly good laboratory to learn the Dharma in, right? You just have to know how to look.
If the rituals and the monastic way of living is an expression of enlightenment, then doesn't that call into question then the whole issue of enlightenment, the whole significance, the whole meaning of it, which basically is what this book is about, you know, kind of one story after another.
Yeah, it's, well, the whole damn thing is, what do you think enlightenment is, right? What is it, right? What does it do? What does it look like? For Dogen, it is this enlightenment is sitting, is this form of life, right? Is this way of getting off the treadmill of means to an end, right? Not using, you know, he takes the monastic life as a kind of given and says, the thing that you're already doing is it,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not like this thing you're doing needs to be done differently or through multiple lifetimes or anything like that. The thing that you're already doing, seen from the right perspective, is it, right? He's basically talking to the monks.
But is it only that thing, or could the thing be planting a cornfield? Or,
well, we think it could be a planting a cornfield. Dogen didn't. Mm. You know, I don't think he thought it could be anything.
Anything other than one thing? That's...
It was just that one damn thing. And it's, you know, it's, it just so happens that the enlightened way involves having two vacations a month of 3 days each.
That sounds generous by most monastery standards nowadays.
Well, I think they nowadays they have the 4 and the 9 rule, I think. That's what I thought, that you have off any day ending in 4 or 9.
Oh, wow.
So the 4th, the 19th, the 14th, the 19th, the 24th, the 29th. So,
in the temple, we got 3 days off every 3 months.
See, it's amazing how these absolutes keep changing.
And for 3 years, you don't get an X1 in February.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right, I think that brings us to
another
conclusion. Thank you all.
Bye, Kaysa.
Yeah. 2 years? We've been doing 2 years?